Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, apparently, because now everybody can snap up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. All right. Now, we have a number of guests on the show today who will be sort of doing a bit of a crisscross back and forth, allegedly. So I think if we're lucky, we might have Cameron Wiltshire. Is that you on the Skype there? He's liaising with Randall Carlson at the moment. And what about on the caller line? Do we have Scott Onstott here with us?
I'm here, Vinny.
Hey, Scott, how are you, man?
Good, how are you?
You know, pretty amazing, actually, now that you're here.
Thank you.
Yeah, good, man. And I understand that you're not overly prepared for today's show, and, you know, to be perfectly frank, I'm not that well prepared for today's show either. And Randall is going to be away for the first hour of the show, but we have Cameron to fill in for him. Now, in terms of kind of having a general theme for the show, I don't think we really have one. I mean, we're just going to sit around and have a conversation, have a few laughs. Is that all right with you?
Yeah, that's what I was hoping for. It's just sort of an unscripted conversation.
Yeah, yeah. That pretty much works for me too. Okay, now, Cameron, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, right. So we've got you on via cell phone there, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it seems that there might be two of them. You've called into the caller line, have you? Or have we gotten you on there? Yeah, you might want to hang up the phone and just use this. You might want to hang up the phone and just use the Skype. Yeah. Here we go. All right, that works better. And we'll probably be joined by Randall Carlson in the second hour as well via cell phone if he hasn't called into the caller line. All right. So, Cameron, I'm familiar with Scott, but not with you. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, well, you know, my name's Cameron. I work with SacredGeometryInternational.com, and I'm basically the guy behind the scenes. I imagine you do tons of work yourself on your show, so I'm the guy doing all the audio, the video, talking to folks online, booking. That's me, in a nutshell.
Okay, fair enough. So you must have a reasonable familiarity with the topic of sacred geometry and what have you. How did you get into this particular field?
It's just purely synchronicity. I ended up staying in a house that I found out later sat upon a subterranean waterway that apparently Native Americans had been traveling for hundreds of years previous to it becoming modernized, and I started having a lot of psychic experiences, precognitive experiences, and then I met Randall, and it all kind of clicked. In a lot of bizarre and strange ways. Even my last name being Wiltshire, of course, Stonehenge is located in Wiltshire County, England. And so apparently there could be some genetic connection to the work I'm involved with Randall. So a lot of weird stuff like that. And I know Scott and yourself can appreciate that.
Yeah, I do appreciate weird stuff.
And Wiltshire is the place where a lot of the crop circles appear. And, of course, there's a lot of sacred geometry in the crop circles. So we come back to Sacred Geometry International and yourself, Cameron.
Thank you for saying that, Scott. Absolutely. And I still want to get a copy of your coloring book because the kid in me is like, can't wait to just start, you know, coloring in some of these forms and seeing what brews in my head from that process.
It's a good way to experience the geometry is to color it in like a kid, you know. That's one way. Another way is to do like the Tibetans and pour colored sand into the diagram. However you choose to go about it, you can gain from meditating on sacred geometry. I think it alters our brain patterns in some kind of harmonious way. And you come out of it sort of feeling a little bit uplifted. And I'm not exactly sure why that happens, but maybe it's part of the architecture of the universe and we're just sort of harmonizing with it when we meditate on these geometries.
I would agree. Have you ever had that experience, Vinny? Aesthetic arrest?
Aesthetic arrest? No, yeah. No, my ones involve handcuffs.
Well, you could be arrested by beauty, and it's a lot more fun.
Yeah.
And and that's what I think people seek when they head to the museum or the sacred site. And that's something we hope to inspire in people through providing them, you know, the left and the right brain equivalent of a lot of this information, hoping that they'll integrate them and then have that experience. Because, you know, that's what Gnosis is. It's the realization of the sublime, the divine in everyday life. And so that's where we're going with this, I hope.
Well, let's talk about this. Can you explain exactly what is a static arrest, as you put it?
Oh, no, excuse me. Aesthetic aesthetic arrest is a quote I got from Joseph Campbell, who, interestingly enough, shares a birthday with Randall Crossan. And, you know, he was a master of comparative mythology, and he found, like, the archetypal underpinning for the heroic journey and basically human myth throughout all cultures. And so aesthetic arrest is... it's like falling in love. It's like becoming filled with light, and I think meditating on it, being in nature, it can happen so many different ways.
Suddenly sit back and go, "Oh my god!" Like that kind of moment.
Right. Yeah, totally. And for anyone out there who's ever done mushrooms and been in nature, you know, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And interestingly enough, you will see. I've heard this from other people, and I've experienced it myself. I've seen actual geometries glowing in front of me, you know, so that's kind of wild. It's like looking through the veil for a second and seeing the code behind everything. And like, oh, yeah, right.
I always wondered that with hallucinogens, whether or not you're actually seeing reality through them, and that when you come back to, you know, so-called sobriety, that's the illusion.
Wow. Yeah, I can empathize with that. What was it? There's like, I think it was famous Japanese poem where the gentleman was remarking upon, you know, he had gone to sleep and he had a dream that he was a butterfly, and then he woke up and he's like, well, am I a butterfly having a dream that I'm a man, or vice versa? You know, I really botched that quote, but you know what I'm saying. I understand what you're saying. Scott, you have any experiences with something like this, I imagine?
Well, it, you know, when you're telling that story, it reminded me of a friend who was meditating on, I think it was the Sri Yantra design, and he was really, focused on it, and he said he went into it, and it was like 10 hours later he came out of it, and he was in this kind of absolute realm where he encountered all kinds of amazing things, including sheer terror. And incredible beauty. So he had this mystical sort of experience just by, you know, intensely staring at some sacred geometry. And I guess you could think of it as an alternative to hallucinogenic substances. Just focusing on these patterns could be a trigger for some people to experience altered states.
What I forget who told me it, Scott, but said that kind of like hallucinogens are sort of like a shortcut, and like every shortcut, they can be a little bit more dangerous than the long way round. You know what I'm saying? Like you could achieve enlightenment, you could achieve a sense of balance in the world without them. You could get a lot of enlightenment without them. It just is certainly in some ways a lot faster, but also there's risks associated with it.
That's right, and you know, it doesn't probably become as much part of you if you take the shortcut rather than sort of working for it and earning that more as a permanent state of consciousness that you have access to.
Well, that's very similar to the way, say, a very wealthy Rockefeller kid or something like that grew up having everything handed to them, including the silver spoon, having no consequence for their actions and things like that, and they turn into a really, really pathetic individual because they have no appreciation for the power or the wealth that they have.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's all about appreciation and gratitude for these states, I think. And if you get there so easily, you might not have the same kind of appreciation. You know, you might take it more for granted that, you know, you take this substance, you get to this space, you know, rather than sort of working yourself into that mode so that you can learn something more about consciousness and hopefully ground that in your waking state of reality so that it affects your life. It helps gives you additional perspectives with which to solve problems in your daily life, for example.
Mm. Yeah. I do think that solving problems in your daily life is probably the most important thing that people should be doing on a daily basis, you know what I'm saying? Because I don't know about you, but I'm a bit of a procrastinator, right? So I've got all these problems and lists of stuff to do that I'm just kind of putting off and putting off and putting off. And before I know it, they've obtained a mountainous volume that it's almost like I don't know where to start, and I should have been doing it all along. And I think that's the same for things that you have to do in your work life as things you have to do in your emotional life. If you ignore these things that make you tick, if you ignore what makes you passionate and happy or growing, you know, that kind of thing, you're going to wind up crushing yourself in a lot of ways, psychologically, spiritually, etc.
Yeah, it's a very subtle thing, I think, sometimes to listen to your inner voice or inner, you know, intuition about what it is that you really need to do or what it is that you find the most interesting or most passionate about. And if you're not paying attention to that, it can go right past you, and then you're just sort of wondering, why am I feeling so lost, you know? But I think there is, if we can get more in touch with our inner selves, we can, you know, have more guidance and have more of a sense of being on the right path. And I'm intrigued by how that sometimes can be mirrored in the external world. You know, when you has this ever happened to you where you're thinking about some subject, and then suddenly you'll see that somehow expressed in the world around you, and when that happens, you feel like you're on the right path. You're on the right track or something.
It happens to me daily, but I get these hints. Like a thought will come into my head, say of a box of chocolates, and then I'll go over to my sister's place, and she arrives home seconds after I arrive there. I'm supposed to drop off a key to her, and wherever she was, whatever she was doing, somebody'd given her a box of chocolates. Like, just me having the thought of a box of chocolates beforehand and then seeing the box of chocolates, there's no actual benefit there. It's like, so what, bro? You thought about a box of chocolates. You didn't know what kind of chocolates they were. you know, it was kind of irrelevant. And it happens all the time. It's like you don't know what these things mean, and yet you see evidence for what you're thinking. Other times
it shows
like
how everything is based on consciousness, including external reality. And so if you can see that, then it's really no surprise that things in the external world are mirroring what you're thinking about in your interior, because it's all part of the same dream within a dream, if you will.
Yeah, that's about right. It's just strange though, and I think I interviewed a lady named Nancy Duterte. So she's a the skepticalpsychic.com, and she told me an analogy about psychic ability and how it really works. And so, psychic will be given a folded piece of paper, and they said, "What's in this inside this folded piece of paper?" And they say, "Well, there's a hook, there's a sprocket, and there's a stone." So what's inside the piece of paper? It's, you know, I don't know. You can see the parts for what's in there, but you don't know exactly what's in there, right? Like you get signs, but the interpretation is not there,
there's
thing.
There's a missing piece. It's hard to interpret the whole picture. You just get a few details, maybe.
Yeah.
It's
so
like
they open the piece of paper.
It sort of works that way.
Yeah. So they open the piece of paper, and there's earrings in there that have a sprocket, a stone, and a hook. Right?
Right.
So, despite the thing that you will be shown exactly what's in there, but it'll be done in a roundabout way, kind of. I don't know if you've ever seen the classic TV shows or movies or whatever, where the devil will say something to a character and he'll kind of say it in code, and the character won't get it until after he signs the contract, after it's too late, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I've got a story for you guys.
Well, how about you hold that story until after the break? That was a very inconvenient break there. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few minutes. Scott Onstott and Cameron Wiltshire are my guests for the first hour, and if we're lucky, Randall Carlson will be joining us for the third. Back in a minute, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. The next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Oh yeah. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest at the moment is Scott Onstott, and also, the other person, sorry, I should have said plural, you know, guests with a s. The other one is Cameron Wiltshire. All right, now, Scott, before we were rudely interrupted with the break, you had a story. Do you recall what it was?
I wanted to tell you that I, you know, recently went on a trip to Europe. I went to Italy and France, and I have a little bit of a sketch to tell you of what I discovered in southern France. So I was staying in Provence in kind of a rural hotel there for a few nights, and the closest little village is called Bonnieu. And so we go into Bonnieu, and I'm looking around for secrets in plain sight, which is sort of what I do all the time, but I'm really excited to do this in Europe. And I did a little research on the internet the previous night, and I discovered that Bonnieu was a Templar stronghold back in the 12th century. And so I want to see if I can find any echoes of that statement in the architecture. And there's a beautiful little cathedral and a fortress on the top of the hill, and I'm just astounded with the beauty, and this basically deserted little village is so picturesque and all of that. But I'm looking, you know, I'm not noticing any really what I would call secrets in plain sight. And then we go down to this restaurant for dinner, and it was a fantastic meal. But right before going in there, I noticed that there's a bar next to it, and the title of the bar is 33. And I just go, okay. Just had to laugh because, 33 is a really important number to the Freemasons. It's the, you know, in the Scottish Rite, it's the highest rank. And the Freemasons trace their intellectual heritage back through the Templars. And I just thought, well, this is kind of one of those elements which is showing me I'm on the right track or the right path. And, of course, in the bar, you can buy a soda. And in Europe, the soda cans come in 33 centiliter sizes. So, again, there's the number, 33. And to me, 33 represents the full range, the whole journey. It's like the path from initiation at rank 1 all the way up to 33 is sort of the path of initiation.
From the tailbone to the cranium.
Yeah, that's right. There's 33 bones in the spinal cord, including, and some people say that's in the spinal cord. And other people say the 33rd bone is the skull. And that makes a lot of sense. But there's also all of these other parallels in the natural world, like the sun is 333,000 times more massive than the Earth. Light travels 3.3 nanometers per second. an atmosphere is equivalent to a column of water 33 feet high. I have a whole bunch of these things that I've found in the course of my research. And so 33 is this sort of resonator that represents that full range. For example, you have to go Mach 33 to escape from the gravity well of Earth and leave Earth. You have to exceed Mach 33. So this is how I'm looking at it. I'm so steeped in this particular number. And then when I'm out there looking for something, it just pops up. Why is the bar called 33? You know, I didn't speak French well enough to ask them and find out. But one can speculate, you know, why is that the case? I don't know. But when I see that sort of thing, I take note of it and feel like I'm on the right track.
You know, the number 33 also, for me, holds a very special place. I see it everywhere, Scott, every freaking where I look, you know. Like, for example, just last night, what was the time that I went to bed? 11:33.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it sort of works like this. If you focus on something, it could be a box of chocolate, then that's what you're going to see in the world around you. Or if you focus on 33, then you find all these amazing connections with that number. But it could be anything. The content can change, but in some way, with our focus and intent, it's almost like we can program the world around us to respond to us. And I'm always still amazed when it does, you know?
Why aren't we programming the world to, like, I don't know, overthrow ruthless, lying, criminal psychopaths, or convince people who are slightly retarded from too much mainstream news consumption that 9/11 was an inside job, etc., etc. Maybe our focus is elsewhere, because I think there's a lot of people who have that intention, but it's not manifesting quite so fast or as magically as one might hope.
Well, I think the intent aspect of it, like if you just want to know, you want to find out some more information, that seems to be readily available. But if you want to change someone's opinion or cause some political change in the world or social change, that's asking too much, in a sense, of, you know, having your intent to alter these major structures. I think it's possible, but you might need, you know, greater focus or more clarified intent, or perhaps if you meditated with a bunch of people, you might be able to affect change. And, you know, I know they've done studies on this, and like the crime has been reduced in Washington, D.C. when a bunch of people are meditating on that. There's real, you know, data on how this works. But maybe
is this the same one where the Washington, like, D.C.'s murder capital of the world, right? Incidentally. And he said it would take 6 feet of snow to reduce the crime rate by a third. And so what's a third of 100 to 33%, roughly, right? So they meditated, and then they got the crime rate reduced by 33%.
There you go. And isn't it interesting, 33 pops up again here. It's a nice connection. But
you know, have you ever heard the phrase, things come in threes?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, you know, things actually come in 33s.
Well, or any string of threes. Actually, I find that it's not just threes. It can be any one of the nine digits, 1 through 9. So, for example, the Earth's orbital velocity is 66,666 miles per hour. Why is that? another one is that the Earth's tilt is 23.4 degrees. You know, the obliquity of the Earth, and that's what causes the seasons. And another way of looking at that is to say 90 minus 23.4. So the opposite, I guess it would be a complementary angle. it's 66.6 degrees. So I think that's really interesting as well. The distance from the Tropic of Cancer to the pole is 66.6 degrees. We don't think of it that way. We think of it, oh, the Tropic of Cancer is 23.4 degrees above the equator. But if you give the complementary angle, it has this sort of resonance with this repetition of digits. And so somehow this repetition of digits is a key. And it doesn't even matter what units you're using, because it seems to happen with all measurement systems. An acre is a furlong times a chain, and that's 660 feet times 66 feet. Why is that? You know, it's just these string of repetitive digits. I think that people subconsciously prefer the strings of repetitive digits. And this might be why a lot of bank addresses are, you know, 333 Main Street or 444 Market Street or whatever. There might be sort of a subconscious preference for that.
Do you think that these things are known by certain people and implemented, or do you think maybe actually the majority of the time it's just people doing what they feel is natural and it just turns out like that?
I think it's the latter explanation. But occasionally people are conscious of it. But most of the time people aren't, and they nevertheless choose to make all soda cans 33 centiliters. Because it's kind of like a third of a liter. But did they know about Freemasonry? Did they know about all the 33s and how they tie in with the natural world? I doubt it. I think that they just, people naturally gravitate to these sort of, I don't know what to call them, but islands of resonance or key numbers, sacred numbers. They're part of the matrix that we're in. They're part of our bones. They're part of everything. So it should be no surprise that people do that. But I guess the thing is to become more conscious of it so that you're aware of what you're doing and can marvel at the wonder of, you know, so many things around you that you usually don't even think twice about.
That's true. There's a new beer being advertised here in New Zealand called Export 33.
There you go. Yeah. It sounds a lot better than Export 34 for some reason.
Yeah. Cameron, did you have something to add in here?
I like the line of thinking. I can reflect on my own life where certain numbers pop up redundantly and they seem to guide me. So if I'm stressed, say, over money or health or what have you, the world at large, then I'll look to my clock and I'll say, oh, I'm thinking this, it's 1:11, and what prompted me to look over at this time and remember that this is a sacred number related to the sun, like Scott was describing. So you could say our orbital velocity around the sun in miles per minute is 1,110. So there's that triple one again, miles per minute. And so it's kind of like as you become aware of these numbers and you know the larger phenomenon they're associated with, it kind of helps you keep the bigger picture in mind. And so you can kind of get over your little petty fears and doubts and elevate your consciousness and tap into this larger framework that, you know, I gather my existence from.
Well, so, think about this. It's like life and geometry are both infinite scale objects, so they infinitely go up in size and infinitely go down in size. You know what I'm saying? There's this dude who created a microscope, I believe, early 1900s, been suppressed apparently, that managed to get 60,000 times magnification as opposed to the normal 10,000 times. And so he was able to look inside cells. You know, normally when you're looking down in a microscope, you can look at the cell walking around and stuff like that. He was able to look into the cell that you were looking into. And it turned out that that little cell was made up of all these other cells. So he looked into one of those other little cells, and it was made up of all these other little cells. And so he looked into one of those other little cells, and it was made up of all these other little ones. It was like life upon life upon life upon life upon life built infinitely downwards down the scale. And I theorize that maybe there's infinite size and complexity of organisms infinitely up the scale as well, you know, beings that are larger than us that we accompany, like we're a cell in its body kind of thing, going about our own business independently in a truly biological function, having no idea the part that we play in some greater creature. And then I see the sacred geometry thing being exactly the same. You have a look at any of these different measurements or speeds or distances, things of that nature, and they all seem to revert back to something and be constantly reinterpreted, but still coming up with the exact same thing, infinitely up the scale, infinitely down the scale. It's like the structure of the universe is like a double helix, one part life and one part geometry.
And we have the privilege of being right in the middle of the, of those telescoping and microscoping scales. You know, let me read you a couple of sentences from my Volume 2 movie. The scale at which the structure of space-time becomes dominated by quantum effects, known as the Planck length, is 33 orders of magnitude smaller than a pair of dice. And then the volume of the sun has a volume 33 orders of magnitude larger than a pair of dice. So we're right in the middle of those 33s. And the pair of dice I just chose because I think the measure was like 1.4 centimeters or something. And it's about something that will fit in the palm of your hand. So that's roughly human scale. We're right in the middle of the macrocosm and the microcosm.
Wow. Well, that means that we're probably the only ones with the perspective to see both the macro and the microcosm happening simultaneously. Nobody else from on either end of the scale would be able to see the other side through all the mist. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the bleeding uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong
Welcome
with
back.
The world? People kill people that other people command. Middle East is a modern day attack on a native land. Project eugenics planned on the common man. Expand the military industrial complex. Annex foreign soil with chemical objects.
Welcome back.
Psyop attacking your conscience. Next, your brain agrees with
Ooh,
the
we've got some problems here. We've got some problems with the old sacred geometry, ladies and gentlemen. It's all coming down, it's all collapsing, and people are all confused and stuff like that. And then there's, you see conspiracy everywhere, even when it's pure coincidence. And you see pure coincidence, even when it's pure conspiracy. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, The Lighter Side of Genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and confusing stuff, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guests, Scott Onstott and Cameron Wiltshire. Now, we will be having Randall Carlson as well drop in to join us for the second hour, quite likely, eh, Cameron?
That's correct. He should be here any minute. He's just stuck in that Atlanta traffic.
Yeah, I understand traffic. I live in a city called Auckland, and yeah, if you don't have a car in Auckland, you're screwed. And if you have a car in Auckland, it takes ages to get anywhere. Because
Cameron,
everybody at Auckland's
going to... let me ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Sure. No, please go ahead.
So let me ask you, is this a coincidence or a conspiracy? The distance from Silbury Hill to the Shard in London is 123,456 meters. And that also equals 66.66 nautical miles. So,
Wow. First
of all, are you familiar with Silbury Hill and the Shard?
I'm somewhat familiar with Silbury Hill being in, I believe, in Wiltshire County as well.
That's right. And
the Shard, I'm not familiar with.
Silbury Hill is the tallest prehistoric human-made mound in Europe, and the Shard is the tallest building in the European Union, which is recently completed, I believe, last year. And so what's up with that distance between them from point to point? You can measure it in Google Earth, verify it for yourself. Is it a coincidence or is it a conspiracy?
I think it's a conspiracy in that, not in necessarily a negative one. It could be that the geomancers of old, their information has been carried forward, and there are certain initiates who have this knowledge, and they may be utilizing some type of psychic wavelength toward some effect, you know, for better or worse.
Who was the architect
of the Shard? Not recalling right now.
And then who financed the build? Like, who owns the land? Is there a lease of some description? Is it owned by the Queen and things of that nature? Because I think when you're determining whether or not something's the result of a conspiracy or a coincidence, if you have a look at the people involved and if they happen to be part of secret societies or the royal court or something like that, then it kind of ups the ante a little bit, and you think, you know what, these people might know that, and then investigate further. Go up to them with a camera and just go, excuse me, why exactly is the Shard 66.66 nautical miles from this Silbury Hill, Mr. Rothschild? What is it? Why is that? Come on.
And why is the Shard's address 32 London Bridge? Another sacred number, of course. 32 and 33 are very interrelated, not only because they're next to each other, because it's part of the Scottish Rite, and how you can earn the 32nd degree on your own, and then you have to be asked to go on to the 33rd degree, you know, and to sort of make that final step. And I wanted to, this would be great if Randall could join us on this, because, you know, he's a Freemason. Is he a 32nd degree member, Cameron?
That's correct.
Yeah, so I'm sure he'd have an opinion on whether this is a Freemasonic conspiracy or not. I tend to think it's more of a coincidence rather than a conspiracy, but that doesn't make it less amazing to me. I think it makes it even more sublime that this is somehow, we are all sort of actors, like Shakespeare would say. We're all actors that play our part, and the architect maybe decided to, you know,
what's the height of the building, I wonder?
We'd have to, look it up on Wikipedia and find that.
Okay. So, the Shard, London, height. It is 308 meters. 308 mean anything to you?
No, not particularly.
Does the fact that the Shard looks like a giant, really, really, really tall pyramid to you mean anything?
Well, pyramids are part of the deal, but...
And it's a pyramid, and it's also got a cube structure on the side of it, too.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, there's a lot of little things in here, couldn't you think? What's 308 meters in feet?
We'd have to do the calculation.
Okay, 308 meters. Meters convert to feet.
Everybody got your decoder rings.
Yeah, it is 1,010 feet. Oh.
So 10. You have that nice repetition of ones there. The zeros are not to be counted in a sense because they're placeholders in the decimal system.
Yeah. Okay, so it's like an 11.
It's like an 11, yeah.
And 11's, and what does an 11 mean?
Another repetitive sequence of digits.
So like there's other things like 9-11 and 7-7 and things of that nature.
That's right.
Repetitive digits. They mark something important, don't they?
Again, it's similar. In my mind, it's similar to any string of repetitive digits, the 11s or the 3s. 33.33 times 33.33 is 1111. So they're connected in that sense.
And the address is 32, so would you say, like, 32 times 32, blah, 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 is 1010, or no, there's a different calculation entirely?
I think it's something different there.
Okay. Well, see, you know, it always gets you curious, and sometimes, you know, you got nothing. and you don't know whether or not things are intentional or conspiracy, as you say.
But you can take note of them either way. It sort of rings bells in my mind when I see things like that, and I'm like, wait, this is important. And it's sort of up to each individual to determine, I think, if it's a conspiracy or if it's evidence of higher consciousness or something. It's really your own outlook. If you perceive the world as a global conspiracy, then that's fantastic, and you're going to see that there. But if you see it as evidence of interaction with aliens or something, you could say that that's what it is. Or if you think it's just a random chance, then you have every right to think that there's nothing to it at all. So it's really, I think it says more about our own consciousness, about how what we think about these things. And that's the interesting part to me, is what do people think about these connections, and what does it say about their worldview? And you can think about that yourself and see where it leads you.
My worldview is basically comprised of three words: I don't know.
That's wisdom. I think the more we learn, the more certain we are that we don't know it. We don't know very much at all. And to keep an open mind, right?
Yeah. I mean, somebody could come up with evidence and, call in and tell us the name of the architect, and he's incidentally a 33-degree Freemason, and the build was incidentally financed by the Rothschild family, who incidentally took loans from the Bank of England, which they own, in order to do it, and incidentally was commissioned on 7/7/2004 or something like that. Right. You know, it's quite funny because sometimes that does happen when there's such a massive link of coincidences that it's just like, oh my God, there's a real intent here. But, you know, in this case, it's just pure speculation. And it's fun to speculate, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I would love it if we could link this to the Rothschilds and go down that path further, but I don't, you know, we'd have to really work on that, and it might not be the case in this particular example, but it's endlessly entertaining to see where these rabbit holes go, and to keep an open mind, because anything is possible, and it's when we decide that it's only this one way that I think that's when we get into trouble, and can be easily disproven by people who are looking at it in a different way.
Now, on top of this, there's a lot of things that become open to interpretation to people, and I remember what Jan Irvin tells me about the Trivium, how you can ask a certain amount of questions, you know, who, what, when, where, why, and how they did it, and what have you. And that way, once you get the answers to those questions, and they're pretty straightforward, anybody who actually was there, who actually did such and such, would know the answers to those very simple questions. If they can't answer, like, one or two of them, then, you know that they don't really know what they're talking about. If, on the other hand, they can answer all of them, then it's absolutely a significant possibility that they're telling the truth. But it doesn't mean if they can't answer them that it's not the truth entirely. You know, you've got to be able to run with the punches, as it were. Roll with the punches, sorry. That was a misquote. But anyway, the point is, we just don't really know a lot of the time unless we research it. And who's got time for that a lot of the time? We'll be right back after the break.